Hello and welcome to Nothing But Space, a weekly podcast where we talk about everything related to our universe, including the Milky Way, black holes, and other observable and non-observable phenomena. I'm your host, Francesca Fernandez, and today I will be taking you through what I hope to be a transformative journey. So, a couple episodes back, we talked about Einstein's theory of special relativity and how it affects space and time, and how it connects the two. And as a finale to our two-part series on Einstein's very famous theories, today we'll be covering the much more difficult theory this time, which is Einstein's theory of general relativity. And now, both of these theories are honestly very, very cool and very, very interesting ideas to explore. And just to give you a heads up to maybe ease your fears a little bit, Einstein's theory of general relativity is really just an expansion of his theory of special relativity, and it honestly just postulates even cooler ideas. So don't be scared. If you've watched the first episode on special relativity, which was episode 8 of this podcast, then you're all ready to listen to this one. And if you haven't seen that episode, go check it out. You will be glad you did. It will prepare you. And once you've done that, once you've listened to that, once you're ready to hear more about Einstein's theories, keep on listening. So now I'm assuming that you've already listened to episode 8 of the podcast, or you already know Einstein's theory of special relativity and you're ready to dive into this episode. But if you're a slacker, here is a quick review of special relativity, just because I want to make sure that we're all ready and prepared for the cool shit that we're about to listen to. So first, special relativity. Just to give you a very brief summary, it's essentially the idea that the speed of light is kind of like the ultimatum, and the motion through space plus motion through time will always equal speed of light. So what that means is that the speed of light is constant in all reference frames. So the faster you're moving, that doesn't mean that the speed of light is going to appear or it's going to be any different. What it means is that just if you're moving faster, then motion through time is going to be less, right? Because motion through space plus motion through time is equal to the speed of light. Now, the reason that Einstein's theory of general relativity is an expansion of the theory of special relativity is because special relativity, as I said earlier, it basically connected space and time. And so now with the theory of general relativity, what we're going to do is we're going to bring in gravity. Okay, so we're expanding on the idea of space and time, bringing in gravity. And that should make sense in the name too, because right, we have like Einstein's theory of special relativity, which applies to the specialized cases of space and time only, or when we're only looking at these two functions. But once we're looking at gravity, once we're looking kind of at how our universe works as a whole, right, the way that space and time is affected by bodies of mass, that is what general relativity applies to. And so now that everyone is up to date, okay, we're ready to dive into the good stuff, let's go. General relativity, baby. Okay, so first, honestly, the majority of this podcast is not going to focus on actually defining general relativity, because really, I think the coolest part of general relativity is the implications it has, especially in space. So I'm gonna give you guys a definition. I really don't think general relativity, like, as a definition is too hard to understand. I think the more interesting part, and probably the harder parts to understand, is like what general relativity implies for the rest of our universe. So just for like a bare-faced definition, general relativity is the idea that massive objects, so we're talking about large bodies of mass, like fucking planets, fucking stars, okay, black holes, massive objects warp the fabric of space-time. So they curve it, they stretch it, and this distortion is what we synthesize as gravity, right? So imagine you have like a trampoline and you put a very, very heavy ball in the middle of the trampoline, okay? So then obviously the trampoline fabric is going to distort around it, right? It's gonna stretch around it, it's gonna curve around it. And that is the exact same idea that we're going to apply beyond Earth to like planets, to stars, to black holes, to large bodies of mass, okay? So in this scenario, the trampoline fabric is space-time. And the large bodies of mass are curving space-time, just like the heavy ball curves the trampoline fabric. So gravity, as we can kind of make this conclusion, gravity is essentially a property of space-time. So as we change gravity, we're changing properties in space and time. And that to me is very, very, very cool to think about, right? As you have a changing gravitational field, you have changing properties of space and time, okay? And now also, if we go back to our trampoline analogy, the idea of gravity being kind of like created from distortions in space and time This is analogous to how the gravities of large bodies of mass are pulling other external mass towards it, right? Because gravity is an attractive force. So if we have the gravity of a star, it's going to pull other external masses towards it, right? That's kind of how our whole solar system is intact, because of the force of gravity. And so if we think about the trampoline analogy, it's the same idea as, like, suppose you put a marble on the trampoline. So we have the trampoline, right? And we have our very, very, very heavy ball in the middle of the trampoline. Now, if you put a marble on the trampoline too, it's going to roll towards the center of the trampoline, or it's going to roll towards wherever the heavy ball is. It's the same idea. If we have a very, very, very large star, and we have another smaller body of mass, the large star, its gravity, the way that it's distorting space-time, it's going to pull this other smaller body of mass towards it. So I think the trampoline analogy, I think it's really helpful for thinking about general relativity and kind of envisioning really how space-time could distort. So now I want to move on to the much, much cooler parts of this episode. That was just our definition of general relativity, right? Large bodies of mass distort space-time so in a way that they create gravity. And that is how gravity manifests itself around basically everything that we know. So let's talk about the implications of general relativity for space, because there's a lot of cool stuff. The first one, let's talk about everyone's favorite topic in space ever, black holes, right? Because black holes, as we all know, there's so much mass concentrated in such a small area, right? So black holes have extraordinarily great gravity. And what does this mean based off our definition of general relativity that we just talked about? Well, it means that black holes distort space and time so greatly that light can't escape, right? At a certain point, the event horizon of a black hole, any light that enters can't leave. So part of that is due to the fact that black holes are distorting space and time, right? Because they have such great gravity, they're distorting space and time so greatly that the light cannot escape. And that also means that the time is extremely, extremely slow. So the next implication that I wanted to talk about is gravitational waves. And I haven't brought this up before, so I'll go a little bit more in depth with the idea of gravitational waves. But essentially, gravitational waves are kind of what we call ripples in space-time. So if you've ever thrown a pebble in a pond, or a rock in a pond, or really just, you know, thrown anything in a body of water and seen kind of like the ripples that spread out, that is essentially how we picture gravitational waves. Now, we can't actually see gravitational waves. It's kind of like a notion in our mind that is confirmed by experimental evidence. But if we want to picture gravitational waves, that's what we picture them to look like in space. So gravitational waves are invisible, yet they're very, very fast. They move at the speed of light, and they squeeze and they stretch anything in their path as they pass by. And so I mentioned gravitational waves, I'm telling you about them, but I haven't actually defined like what they are or what they're caused by. Like, I'm just telling you what they look like. So let's talk about what exactly causes gravitational waves, which essentially we can picture as like the ripples that spread out in a pond when you throw a stone in. So gravitational waves are caused by very, very violent processes, right? So if I bump into a table or if I bump into a wall, that is a very, very minute process that is not going to cause any sort of gravitational wave. But when we have massive accelerating objects, and I'm talking massive, not like massive in the sense of like, oh, two cars or something, like fucking massive stars or massive, massive black holes. When we have massive objects that are accelerating, right? They disrupt the very foundations of space-time. And that should intrinsically make sense because, as we said earlier, when we have gravity, that essentially correlates to a curvature or a distortion in space-time. So imagine now that you have these fucking massive objects that are accelerating. Well, accelerating just means there's so much gravity acting upon it, and therefore, there must be a huge distortion in space-time. So massive accelerating objects are disrupting the very foundations of space-time. Okay, and so because of this disruption, this means that waves of regular or undulating or normal space-time, it's propagating in all directions away from the source. So think about it like if we go back to our pond analogy, if we throw a rock in the pond, right, the pond is disturbed. And what does this mean? Well, the pond is going to start rippling away. So it's the same idea. If we have massive accelerating objects, space-time is disturbed. And because space-time is disturbed, it kind of creates these ripples throughout space-time that propagate away, okay? Isn't that just, that is so cool. And so what exactly is being transmitted as gravitational waves? Because I also mentioned that, okay, we can't actually see gravitational waves, but we know that they exist and we know that they correlate with what we think they are because of experimental evidence. So what exactly is giving us this experimental evidence? So as mass is accelerating through this changing gravitational field, the mass is radiating away energy. And that energy that is being radiated away by the mass, that energy is what is transmitted as gravitational waves, and what we can therefore kind of use as evidence to confirm our ideas of gravitational waves. Now, we use gravitational waves to observe lots of phenomena, because as we said, gravitational waves are caused by massive accelerating objects, like violent processes. So what exactly constitutes these violent processes that, you know, cause gravitational waves? Well, here's a couple. One of them is colliding black holes. So if we have two black holes, as we said, black holes have so much mass. If we have two black holes that collide, right, it's going to disrupt the very foundations of space-time because there's so much mass. So there's such a disruption in the curvature of space-time. And then that is going to cause these gravitational waves that we can then observe. Similarly, supernovae also causes gravitational waves. And the last one is colliding neutron stars. And so this is basically the same as like colliding black holes, right? You're gonna have these large bodies of mass that collide, they're disrupting the curvature of space-time, and then they're gonna cause these gravitational waves as they radiate away energy. And the energy that is radiated away, that is what is transmitted as gravitational waves. And so the reason that it took us such a long time to detect gravitational waves, it's kind of hard to detect gravitational waves because even though they're caused by very violent processes, which we would assume correlates with the idea that, okay, gravitational waves must be huge, they must be so observable because they're caused by such violent processes. Well, initially they are huge. Initially they are destructive. But as the gravitational wave propagates throughout space-time, it becomes smaller and smaller. And so I'm gonna go back to our pond analogy for this. As we throw a rock into the pond, the ripples right around the rock are very, very large. They're very, very, very easily observed. But as we go farther and farther away from the rock, so if we draw like a circle around the rock, as we increase the radius of the circle, the ripples around the rock are gonna be smaller and smaller, and they're gonna be harder and harder to observe. So it's the same idea with these gravitational waves, right? Gravitational waves are initially very huge, very destructive, right? But as we get farther and farther away from the source that causes gravitational waves, so for example, the colliding black holes, well, the gravitational waves are gonna become smaller and harder to observe. So by the time that these fucking waves, by the time they reach Earth, they're so much smaller and it's so much harder to detect. And that is why Kip Thorne and many physicists, that is why they won the Nobel Prize for this, because they created LIGO, which is able to detect these gravitational waves and confirm what we've been thinking all along. So the last part of this episode, I personally think, is probably the coolest part. So a big mystery in physics today is that with regards to general relativity, Einstein came up with a set of non-linear partial differential equations which have yet to be solved. So he has these equations all laid out, and we don't have a concrete solution to them. Now, there are a few possible solutions, which I will discuss today. There are even more than what I'm going to tell you, but some of the solutions are very, very, very complex and way beyond like what I consider to be the scope of this podcast. The next few solutions I'm going to tell you, these are all black hole solutions to these equations. So these are black hole solutions that would exist in an empty universe, okay? So the first one is known as the Schwarzschild solution, and this is basically equivalent to the Schwarzschild black hole, if you've heard of that. And that's basically a black hole that exists without any angular momentum or electric charge, right? So black holes typically have three defining properties, okay? They have mass, they have electric charge, and they have angular momentum. But the Schwarzschild solution to these partial differential equations, this solution, it's a black hole without any angular momentum or any electric charge. So what that means is that these black holes cannot be distinguished from any other black hole except by mass. So basically, you've lost every single distinguishing property except mass. The next black hole solution is known as the Riesner-Nordström metric. And this one is pretty simple. This is essentially a black hole that has electric charge, so it is charged, but it's non-rotating. So it's a black hole without angular momentum, but it has charge. The next variation of that is also a solution to these equations, is known as the Kerr metric. And so this is kind of like the opposite of the Riesner-Nordström metric. So this is a black hole that is rotating, but it's not charged. So it has angular momentum, but it has no electric charge. And then the last black hole, which is kind of like the conglomeration of all of these black holes, is known as the Kern-Newman metric. And this is essentially a black hole that has both angular momentum and charge. So you can see that we've come quite a ways, because the Schwarzschild solution, that was a black hole without angular momentum or electric charge, right? And the Riesner-Nordström metric and the Kerr metric, those are black holes that have one of those two properties. So either they have angular momentum but no charge, or they have no angular momentum but they have charge. And lastly, we have the Kerr-Newman metric, right? And that is a black hole that has both angular momentum and charge. And so the four of these solutions, right? The Kerr-Newman metric, the Kerr metric, the Riesner-Nordström metric, and the Schwarzschild solution. Let's talk about the other general relativity solutions that exist. And so these are no longer black hole solutions. So the next few that we're going to discuss are actually universe solutions. So let me tell you what that means. And I'll do it by giving you an example. So one of the first solutions is known as the Friedman-Lemaître-Robertson-Walker. From now on, we're going to refer to these as FLRW. So this is a universe that is essentially homogeneous and isotropic. And you'll remember a couple episodes ago, we were talking about what it means for something to be homogeneous and isotropic in the context of space. But essentially, homogeneous means that the properties of matter and the geometry in space-time is same on the macroscopic scale at every point in space. And so what that means is that if we zoom out, so if we take a very, very large lens when we look at space, right, we don't look at the very specific clumps and bumps and bits and pieces of space. If we really just look at space as a whole, right, on the macroscopic scale, okay, I have to repeat that phrase because that is the most important part. Then the matter in space-time and the properties of matter and the types of matter that we're going to see, it's basically the same at every point in space, right? And so obviously you're going to say, like, this is not true on the microscopic scale, because we're really, really thinking on a very, very macroscopic scale, right? On a smaller scale, on a scale that even we would probably consider as macroscopic, right, you're going to have different properties of matter, right? For example, in one clump of space, you could have maybe an entire galaxy with a bunch of stars. And in another clump of space, maybe just have empty space. But if we really zoom out on a very, very macroscopic scale, the amount of matter and the types of matter in space-time is going to be essentially the same at every point in space. And so isotropic is a very similar idea. If the universe is isotropic, that means that on the macroscopic scale, in whatever direction you look, you're going to see the same thing. So again, on the microscopic scale, or even what we may consider the macroscopic scale, you could probably contest this, right? In one direction you see a star, in another direction you don't see a star. Well, on the macroscopic scale, so again, if we really, really zoom out, then in whatever direction you look in space, you're going to see the same thing. So that's basically what the FLRW universes are. It produces a universe which is homogeneous and isotropic. But there's a catch. They're not only homogeneous and isotropic, they're also expanding or collapsing. And so this should sound very similar to you, because the universe that's described by Big Bang cosmology, our universe, which is expanding, doesn't that sound very similar to the FLRW universes, right? Because our universe is homogeneous, it's isotropic, again, on the macroscopic scale, and it's expanding. So the expanding universe that we've described using Big Bang cosmology, that sounds a lot like the FLRW universe. So our universe sounds a lot like this universe. And the next universe we want to talk about is known as the De Sitter universe. And this one is basically the FLRW universe, but without matter or radiation. And it's expanding. So remember, with the FLRW universes, they could be expanding or collapsing, right? The De Sitter universe is essentially an expanding universe that has no matter or radiation. So it's still homogeneous and isotropic, but you cannot have any normal matter or dark matter or any sort of radiation in it, right? Whereas the FLRW universe allowed you to have matter. And in the De Sitter universe, expansion is driven by the cosmological constant, which is a kind of complex idea, but essentially, if you know what dark energy is, expansion is driven by dark energy. So essentially, De Sitter universes, right, they don't allow for matter. But suppose that we decided to be like tricky little rascals and we decided to put in some matter. So let's take a De Sitter universe, which is basically completely empty and expanding by the cosmological constant, and let's put in two people. Well, because it's expanding by the cosmological constant, these two people are going to be propelled away from one another. And eventually this expansion, because it's exponential, it's going to grow faster than the speed of light. So the physical distance between these two people that we've placed in the De Sitter universe, it's going to be greater than the speed of light. It's going to be growing greater than the speed of light. Now, if we apply this to our own universe, so say that we somehow took our universe to be a De Sitter universe, then all we would be able to see is our own Milky Way galaxy. And so you might be thinking, Why is this even relevant? Because as I said, the De Sitter universe, it has no mass in it. But clearly our universe has tons and tons of mass. Why is this relevant to our own universe? The reason that we are so interested in exploring De Sitter space and De Sitter universes is because they're very applicable to how our early universe could have looked during cosmic inflation. And so just a quick rundown, cosmic inflation is the idea that during the Big Bang, the universe expanded so much in basically like a trillionth of a second. So it expanded a shit ton in a very, very short period of time. And De Sitter space is a very good model of cosmic inflation. Right? Because in De Sitter space, you have an expanding universe with no mass in it. And during cosmic inflation, you essentially had a very, very, very quickly expanding universe. And there wasn't really anything in the universe yet. There was stuff in the universe, in our universe, but not really that much. So De Sitter space is a very good model for our universe during cosmic inflation. Now let's talk about anti-De Sitter space. So that's basically the opposite of De Sitter space, right? It's basically De Sitter space, but the cosmological constant is negative. So what does that mean? Well, De Sitter space is expanding, right? So anti-De Sitter space is going to be contracting, okay? And we're going to call anti-De Sitter space ADS now, just to also save my vocal cords. And so the reason that anti-De Sitter space relates to us is because of the fact that our universe could be a De Sitter brain in an anti-De Sitter bulk, right? Because you're probably wondering, like, okay, if anti-De Sitter space is contracting, clearly our universe is doing anything but that, right? Our universe is expanding. It's definitely not contracting. So why the hell does anti-De Sitter space matter to us, okay? Why are physicists so intrigued by it when our universe clearly models De Sitter space much more? And so the reason anti-De Sitter space relates to us is because our universe could be a De Sitter brain in an anti-De Sitter bulk. And so a couple episodes ago, I believe it was the string theory episode, we talked about exactly what the brain and the bulk is. But just a quick summary if you haven't listened to it or if you don't remember, the bulk is essentially the idea that there are more dimensions beyond our own, but these are dimensions that we cannot witness or partake in, so we exist within them. So the dimensions that we can witness and can partake in, these are the brain, and then the dimensions that we cannot witness and cannot partake in at all, which exist, but they're just so beyond the scope of what we can observe and like beyond the scope of our own universe, that is the bulk, okay? So the idea here is that our universe could be a De Sitter brain, right? So the dimensions of our universe that we can observe, they're expanding, right? Just like the De Sitter space. So our universe could be a De Sitter brain, but the entirety of existence as a whole, right? Like the bulk, all these dimensions that we also cannot witness, those could be anti-De Sitter. So those could be contracting while our specific brain, B-R-A-N-E, is expanding. A few more facts about anti-De Sitter space, or ADS. The big idea here is that ADS is unstable. And it's kind of interesting to actually explore that because the boundary of anti-De Sitter space is reflective. So any waves hitting it will bounce back to the point where a black hole eventually forms, right? And if you remember, De Sitter space and anti-De Sitter space cannot harbor any sort of mass. So let's do a deeper explanation of this. So because the boundary of ADS is reflective, imagine that you have a wave hitting ADS, right? Well, because the boundary is reflective, the waves are going to bounce back. And what this means when the waves bounce back, that the matter and energy in these waves, right, in these gravitational waves or in whatever waves, they're going to become concentrated in one place. And what do we know is concentrated matter and energy? Well, if we think about it, really having a ton of matter concentrated in one place, that is basically a black hole, okay? But why does this mean that ADS is unstable? Well, by definition, ADS has uniform curvature everywhere, right? And that's part of the reason that it cannot harbor any mass is because the curvature is uniform. And once you have large bodies of mass, well, as we talked about with general relativity, the curvature is going to be distorted. So ADS has uniform curvature everywhere. But because the waves bounce back and then eventually concentrate matter and energy to the point where a black hole forms, harboring this black hole is going to distort the space-time, and it's going to ruin the uniform curvature of ADS. So once anti-De Sitter space accumulates a black hole, it becomes unstable since its curvature is no longer uniform. We're going to talk about a couple more solutions to Einstein's non-solved, non-linear partial differential equations, and then we're going to wrap it up, okay? So just hang tight. The next universal solution, or universe solution, I guess, is called the Taubnau solution. And this is pretty simple. We're going to go over it in 2 seconds. It's basically a universe that is homogeneous but not isotropic, right? So the properties of matter and the bodies of mass, on the very, very macroscopic scale, they are the same everywhere in this universe. But when you look in different directions, or when you look at a different view of space-time, on the macroscopic scale, it's not going to look the same everywhere. Now, the last universe that we all want to talk about, okay, this is known as the Gödel universe. And this is personally, I think, one of the coolest solutions to Einstein's partial differential equations, right? And why is that? That is because the Gödel universe allows for time travel. So what is the Gödel universe? Essentially, this is a homogeneous, rotating universe which contains closed time-like curves, which could allow for time travel. Now, what are closed time-like curves? Because that sounds like such a fancy space term. Well, essentially, closed time-like curves are paths through space and time that enable you to be present for one event, and then you can somehow travel through space to encounter the same event again. So, it's not as if this event is a recurrence of the original event, so it's not like you're witnessing the original event, and then you travel through space, and you see the same event again, but it's a recurrence of the original event. No. It is the original event. And what that means is that closed time-like curves could lead to paradoxes, okay? They could lead to shit that doesn't make sense. It could lead to illogical nonsense, right? Because if you're traveling throughout space to a point where you're witnessing the original event again, you can't even distinguish what the past is from the future. And that will lead to a bunch of improbable shit, okay? This could apply to science as a whole. So for example, if we have closed time-like curves in the Gödel universe, imagine that you have an electron traveling through these closed time-like curves. Then the electron could not come to existence at all. But then what if this electron is the very foundation of our universe? So then because the electron has somehow traveled through the closed time-like curve and not come to existence, that itself is already a paradox because the electron has existed to travel through these closed time-like curves, but in doing so, it doesn't come to existence. And then that prevents the universe from ever becoming the way that it should exist, right? But then that's also another paradox because in this case, for the electron to have traveled through the closed time-like curve, the Gödel universe must already exist since the Gödel universe is what is giving rise to these closed time-like curves. And there are a few other general relativity solutions that also use time travel and closed time-like curves. So one of them is known as the Tipler cylinder, which is apparently and essentially the idea that an object could be a method of time travel if its length is infinite or if it uses negative energy, right? So the scientist Tipler showed in his 1974 paper that if we have an infinitely long cylinder spinning among a longitudinal axis, that is going to create a frame-dragging effect. Or what that means is that the cylinder, since it's infinitely long and it's spinning, is going to drag space-time with it. And by doing so, it warps the space-time such that the light cone of objects in the cylinder's proximity, they begin pointing backwards. And what does it mean for these light cones to begin pointing backwards? That means that you can time travel, okay? That means it's pointing backwards along the time axis of space-time. So that's one general relativity solution, which also uses closed time-like curves to allow for time travel. The other one is known as traversable wormholes. So I'm going to go over these very, very brief because I want to do an entire episode on wormholes. They're just so fascinating. But essentially, a wormhole is going to create a shortcut between two points of space-time, right? And that sounds super cool, but don't get your hopes up because they're so unfeasible right now. Wormholes are extraordinarily unstable, so they collapse almost instantaneously. So even if we have a shortcut between two points of space-time that would technically allow you to time travel, it's so unstable that it's going to collapse instantaneously before you can even, you know, get in the fucking wormhole. And the only way that we can make these wormholes stable is if we create them using negative energy or negative mass, okay? And I will explain that in the episode that I do on wormholes, but let's just say that right now we can't really do that. And so if we cannot create a wormhole using negative energy or negative mass, then we cannot create a wormhole that is stable. And so we can't really use these wormholes to time travel. But in this scenario, like if we really just suspend our reality for a while, in the scenario that a traversable wormhole was somehow created to the point where it's very stable and it doesn't collapse instantaneously and we can travel through it, then we could technically travel through time using a closed time-like curve. Lastly, let's go over a couple of alternatives to Einstein's theory of general relativity. First one is known as the Brans-Dick theory, and this is the idea that the gravitational constant G is not constant, but it's replaced by a scalar field which varies from place to place and time to time, right? So when we think about the gravitational constant right now, well, by the title, it is constant. But the Brans-Dick theory says, like, okay, in Einstein's theory of general relativity, the gravitational constant is not constant. It's actually a scalar field which varies. And the next one is known as FR gravity. So that's F parentheses, capital R parentheses, and gravity. And this is basically Einstein's theory of general relativity, but much more generalized. So FR gravity is a family of theories where each different theory is defining a function. So one of these functions is representing Einstein's theory of general relativity, but the other functions are explaining different things. So FR gravity tells us even more about the universe than Einstein's theory of general relativity does. These other functions are explaining the universe's accelerated expansion, they're explaining structure formation, and they attempt to explain quantum gravity. So through FR gravity, we're not only getting Einstein's theory of general relativity, we're also getting a lot of other information. So you've made it to the end. That was basically the entire amount of information that I wanted to dump on you guys. Well, isn't Einstein's theory of general relativity so cool? Okay, so thank you so much for listening. General relativity is epic as fuck, okay? My voice just cracked. And the way that it connects to special relativity, it's so beautiful, really. I love it, okay? And so I hope that this two-part series on Einstein's famous theories helped you learn the basis of two very important and fundamental theories in science. But as always, before I let you go, before we wrap it up, let's do a quick summary, okay? So first, let's summarize the definition of general relativity. Obviously, Einstein's theory of general relativity states that large bodies of matter warp space-time and curve space-time. Now, I personally feel that the best parts of this episode go way beyond just the definition of Einstein's theory of general relativity. So let's talk about its implications for space, okay? The first one is gravitational waves, right? Which is when massive accelerating objects or very violent processes, they disrupt the foundations of space-time and radiate away energy, which is then transmitted as a gravitational wave. There's also a couple of solutions to Einstein's nonlinear partial differential equations, which are super cool and posit really cool ideas in our universe. We had four black hole solutions, each of them positing different black holes that either have angular momentum or electric charge. The other general relativity solutions involve various universes. So we have the Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker, which is a universe that is homogeneous, isotropic, and expanding and collapsing. We have the De Sitter and anti-De Sitter, which are universes that are opposites of each other, but the De Sitter universe was essentially the FLRW universe, but without any matter or radiation. We have the Talbot-Knot universe, which is a universe that is homogeneous but not isotropic. We have the Gödel universe, which is homogeneous, but it has fucking closed time-like curves, which means that we can have time travel, baby. And the other solutions that also allow time travel and are solutions to Einstein's theory of general relativity are the Tipler cylinder and traversable wormholes. And then the last thing we briefly mentioned was the two alternatives to general relativity. So obviously the Brans-Dick theory, which states that what we perceive as the gravitational constant is actually not a constant. It's a scalar field varying from place to place and time to time. And then the other theory was FR gravity, which is essentially generalizing Einstein's theory of general relativity into a family of theories, into functions. So one of these functions, right, associated with one of the theories, that is explaining general relativity, but the other functions and theories in FR gravity are explaining much more than general relativity. Okay, once again, and I say this every single time because it's the truth, thank you so much for listening. You guys are G's. Don't forget to run the podcast back up on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Leave us a great review and rating. Okay, I love you guys. Thank you for putting up with my sick voice. Okay, it's disgusting. Okay, okay, thank you. Love you all. Goodbye. Peace.